From London, it's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 40 for Friday, the 26th of August, 2011. On the show this week, the tech world was turned on its head and dunked into a vat of marmalade and surprise this week as Steve Jobs resigned from Apple. But where does the company go from here? Speaking of where is the Higgs boson and are we any closer to finding it? We'll investigate an answer in our feature this week. And can a hard drive full of illegally downloaded media really be considered a work of art? If you ask me, I'd probably use a swear word while screaming hell no. But we'll debate whether that's fair or not as we plough through this week's rich crop of Wired news. Hello. I'm Nate Langson, I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk, and joining me atop Wired's perfectly hexagonal news nest is senior staff writer Duncan Gear.
Hello, hello, hello.
How are you?
I am very well, very well. How are you?
I'm fine. We are very sad to be sans Liv today. She's on holiday at the moment.
We've been sans people for several weeks now, I think.
It's the August fever. Yeah. Where was I last time? Oh, I was here. Actually,
you were here before, but I wasn't because I was on holiday. And before that, you weren't well. And Liv's not here today. So
it's not usually like this, people. If you've only just subscribed, normally there are three of us. And there's a woman, voice.
I can pretend to be a woman if that helps.
Let's not. That's really creepy.
Okay.
Let's crack on with some news. So I think it's fair to say. What do you say? It's fair to say, Duncan, that Steve Jobs resigning finally from Apple is probably the biggest tech news of the year.
Of the year.
What else has been
like on implication or I mean, just on? I mean, it's a big story.
They're the most, or were at one point a few weeks ago, the most valuable company in the entire world. They're certainly the most important tech company at the moment, I would say.
And they're probably the company in the world that relies on its CEO more than any other.
I think it is perceived they rely on their CEO because he is very much the front man of a very talented band. And there are a lot of good people behind him. But obviously, for anyone who doesn't know, Steve Jobs has been off on medical leave for quite some time now. He's been suffering with some illnesses for a while. And Tim Cook, who was previously the company's chief operating officer and has been acting in the CEO position for the last few months, has stepped in to replace Steve Jobs as CEO.
As he has done in the past when Steve's gone off on medical leave and various other things.
He has. I mean, Tim Cook has widely been considered a very strong replacement for Steve Jobs, and I don't think anyone really was surprised that it was Cook that got the CEO position this week.
I just don't know. That sentence just doesn't work for me, though. A replacement to Steve Jobs.
It does.
He's such a monolith of a figure, you know. Does that even make sense? A monolith of a figure? You get what I mean.
I've said weirder stuff, and people understand me.
He's such a titan of the industry that it seems impossible to just consider any kind of replacement to him at all.
He really is, but he's a guy with a vision, but he's not the designer. You know, Johnny Ive is the guy who's basically designed every major Apple product since the iMac, you know, the iPhone, the iPads, all the new MacBooks, things like that. These are all Johnny Ive, who has been at the company for many, many years. And Tim Cook, as chief operating officer, has been, it's not a very glamorous thing to say, I'm the supply chain master. But one of the reasons that Apple gets such amazing profits and has more money than the US government is because
it charges through the nose for its products.
But it can, and its margins are so good because Tim Cook is a master at basically getting companies to sell them components for less than they would sell other people. So, you know, Steve is the guy who could come out with something poetic on stage and no one would bat an eyelid and they just think it's absolutely marvelous and they would clap and cry and be brilliant. You know, Tim Cook hasn't got that same kind of magical aura, if you want to be a bit dramatic about the whole thing. But at the end of the day, the company is about products and their products, I think, will continue to be groundbreaking.
So if that's the case, then why do they have to wheel Steve back off medical leave earlier in the year for keynotes and things like that? If Tim Cook can stand on his own,
you know,
then
what?
Why do they need to do that?
There is a big difference between wheeling someone back in and someone saying, I'm the boss, I'm coming back because I'm really excited. Like, it's no secret that Steve Jobs loves Apple. You know, he comes back in because he wants to. No one's forcing him to. And I think the fact that he has chosen to step down like this is actually incredibly sad on many levels.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, and long-term listeners to this podcast will know that I'm not the world's biggest fan of how Apple tends to operate some of its businesses. But at the same time, I'm going to miss Steve, you know? Mm. I'm going to miss him being in the industry and...
Well, this is the thing. He's not going to not be in the industry as part of this. He is not, you know, he's not leaving Apple in terms of how it's how it moves forward. He's going to be the chairman of the board. So he's still very much going to have his hand on Apple as it moves forward. So
will he still be coming out on stage in his jeans and his
turtleneck? I don't think so, but it wouldn't surprise me if he was, you know, in the audience at some of these things and, you know, maybe, you know, gets a token mention or something. But no, I think from now on, we're going to see a lot of Tim Cook. We're going to see a lot of Johnny Ive, perhaps, you know, and we're going to see more of people like Scott Forstall, who are in charge of the iPhone. So,
and do you think we're going to see a difference in the way the company operates?
Immediately, no. I mean, Tim Cook has been in charge of operations for quite a long time now.
But what about over the kind of medium to longer term?
Well, the thing to remember is that Apple's product line, like many companies' product lines, their pipeline, rather, is very, very long. You know, their products, they're probably testing iPhone 6 at this point, or certainly in late stages of its development, you know, or design at least. And so you won't notice anything radically different now. You know, the iPad 2 and all the recent MacBook Airs and things like that, these have all happened under Tim Cook's hand. So in the immediate future, you'll notice no difference whatsoever. In the medium term, probably very little difference. In the long term, who's to say? But at the end of the day, it's not just Steve Jobs that runs Apple. There are a lot of people in there too who contribute to it. So,
but Steve has only just crowned a week in quite other monumentous tech news as well.
He has, yeah. One of the other things that's happened this week, to move on from the Apple stuff, is that HP, which bought Palm several months ago now, killed the touchpad, the Palm Pre, all the WebOS hardware.
All the Palm stuff.
All the Palm stuff that they spent over $1 billion to acquire not that long ago. They've killed it. It's gone. 49 days after being launched, the touchpad has been killed. And the touchpad, I personally have, you know, said a long time before it came out that I thought it was one of the strongest, if not the strongest, competitor to the iPad, because it basically looked like a first generation iPad, just a little bit fatter. You know, the way it works, the way it handled all this kind of stuff, it was a very strong competitor. But they've killed it.
I mean, I think the real reason is to compete in the world of smartphones and tablets right now, you need to have an app ecosystem. If you don't have one, it doesn't work.
That's so true. And when I had a touchpad for a couple of weeks on a loan for a review, and one of the things that I noticed is that firstly, it felt 2 years old. It felt like the iPad would have felt if it came out 2 years ago. And it just lacked that exciting app ecosystem. Like you said, it had a couple of token great titles on it, like Angry Birds, and they signed a lot of deals with people like Electronic Arts to produce games. But at the end of the day, that's not what makes, you know, that's not what's going to make it succeed, just by having a few apps.
But 49 days, that's got to be some kind of record.
It's not, actually, you know. You know, the Microsoft Kin was killed after 48 days.
48?
So, the touchpad...
Pipped it by a day.
The touchpad lasted one extra day. And I wonder if there's someone on the inside having a bit of a joke to do that. But sometimes companies will do this, and they will buy companies, kill off their main products, and they keep things like the IP, the patents, and the designers and engineers.
Yeah, I think it's the last one, the personnel, that's the really key thing.
That's definitely a key thing here. And we don't think that this is the end of WebOS. It's just the end of the hardware side of things. And there have been rumors that HP was going to stop producing laptops and get out of the laptop business and focus on software. But I had an email this morning from the head of HP's, I think, laptop division, or I can't remember if it was actually charge of the whole of HP in the UK, basically saying we're not getting out of the laptop business. So that's not true either. So it is basically just killing off the tablet and the poor little Pre.
And what does this mean longer term for the, I guess, the competitiveness of the market when it comes to tablets? Is it going to become just iPad, iPad, iPad?
Well, that's the thing. It seems that at the moment, the only tablets people want are the iPad.
Yep.
But that's not necessarily how it's going to be. It's basically these products do take time. People need to catch up. You know, Google Android obviously is a very strong competitor, but it needs to.
They don't have the tablet app ecosystem there. They've got the phone app thing sorted. I mean, they're a great competitor to the iPhone, but they haven't. Their tablet strategy isn't up there with the iPad just yet.
But Google recently bought Motorola Mobility, which I think we reported on last week when you were away, and you know that puts Google in a very interesting position to really boost the hardware side of the Android tablet world, as well as obviously supporting the development of Android, the platform.
It's going to be an interesting couple of years.
It is. I think we've talked enough about tech and tablets for now. I think it's time to blast off through the skies and into some space news. Duncan, you wrote this morning about NASA thinking about laser-based communications in the skies.
That's right. Laser communications is basically just a way of encoding messages through a light beam in exactly the same way that you use in fiber optic cables, except without a cable.
So this is obviously two points of light, what, in space, between a planet, between Mars?
Yeah, potentially. I mean, or between a satellite and Earth, or a space station and Mars, or any two points. You can get information to travel at the speed of light between those two points, and it has, you know, massive bandwidth implications. They're even talking about delivering streaming live video, HD video, from the surface of Mars
now,
using this kind of technology.
Think about that. Think about the next generation of Mars rovers. Then think about it with a giant HD camera on its head, broadcasting. I mean, the cameras can take pictures in enormous resolutions anyway, but imagine having the capability and the bandwidth to stream high def video from Mars.
It would be absolutely incredible. But
it'd actually be quite boring if you think about it. There's nothing on Mars.
It's a load of red rocks.
It's a load of rock.
Well, I'd like keeping my eye out for aliens.
It would be
keep
quite
an eye on the feed.
Don't you think it'd be kind of nice though if they could position it in such a way that you could at certain points in the day see the Earth rise in HD?
That would be lovely. Project it onto a wall in your bedroom or something. This isn't the first time that laser communication systems have been tested in space. There have been previous missions, but this is by far the biggest and best budgeted mission that's going to go up. It's going to go up, it's going to run for 3 years, and then it's hoped that in the future, if it goes well, they could use it on satellites and rovers to deliver these pictures from the surface of exoplanets.
Fabaroo. That's the word I'm using for this.
Baru. And it was. It's not the only project that NASA's working on at the moment. NASA's dedicated $175 million, a big cash pot, to three different promising technologies. The laser got the bulk of it, but they're also testing an atomic clock that could act as kind of, I guess, like a GPS system in space, so that spacecraft know where they are. And also a solar sail that could catch the solar wind and propel spacecraft out of the solar system in that way, using very low amounts of energy.
Well, on that note, we're going to come crashing back to Earth with a brief but concise little ad break, and when we come back, we're going to answer the question, what the hell is going on in Derby?
Registration for the Wire 2011 Summit is now open. Don't miss your chance to hear some of the most inspiring talks from thought leaders of the wired world over 2 days this October in London. For more information, please visit wiredevent.co.uk.
Derby, not normally at the forefront of news, and to be fair, is relegated to fourth place even in our news lineup. But Duncan, you wrote this morning about something called Foursquare Derby 2061, or at least words to that effect.
it's a project called Derby 2061, which a production company called Mudlark is running in the town of Derby.
What does this involve? Because I realised this week or last week that I'd forgotten to use Foursquare for 3 months. Is this going to make me want to A, start using Foursquare again, and B, go back up to Derby where I used to live?
It may well do that. What they've done is they've created fake location points all around the city that are dedicated to, I guess, telling a story about what Derby could look like in 50 years' time, in 2061.
And what could Derby look like? I mean, to be fair, it's not usually where you get people prophesizing the future. I mean, no offense against Derby, I used to live there, but I mean, Go on, excite me. Excite me about Derby.
Well, what you can do is when you arrive, you can, instead of checking into the railway station, you check into the Derby monorail interchange and vacuum subline hub. And then you can take a wander down Queen Street and check into the Atomic Clock Sink Station and into the Silk Mill Hydro Transformer Farm on Full Street.
Hang on, what's a Silk Mill Hydro Transformer Farm?
It's what's going to be in Derby in 2061.
I don't think even in 60-odd years, Derby is going to have anything that sounds that awesome. Although I did like the fact that maybe you would want to go and grab a burger at 3Ds.
I mean, ultimately, this is about using a completely different medium to tell a story. It's to tell the story about how technology is going to develop over the next 50 years and where we're going to be. And the really interesting part is how they've imagined that the economy is going to change. They've sort of conjured up this image of a company which has used the vast amounts of data that are being made public online by people to allow other people to experience their memories. And so you end up with a kind of memory economy where people's emotions and thoughts and feelings get bought and sold.
And if someone's living in Derby and wants to experience the feeling of having their emotions bought and sold, how would they start using this?
All you've got to do is download Foursquare to your phone and have a little wander around the town and look for the points. There's 50 of them. Mudlark's got written a blog post about it, which you can find if you go to our story on the site. And there's also a project wiki which lists all the locations that you can visit.
Cool. Well, I suggest anyone in Derby who's listening to go and try it out. Send us an email, let us know what you think, and we'll read out some opinions next week. Google has been doing something quite interesting with it. Well, it's been doing several things interesting with Street View, which originally was just to look around the roads of places you were maybe planning on visiting.
What are those interesting things?
Well, they have, for one thing, been mounting cameras onto the backs of tricycles to cycle around public footpaths and to make places like Stonehenge navigable on Google Earth and Google Maps. I believe, and I'm fairly sure I'm right in remembering this, that they did the same thing with a kind of a snowmobile, went around Antarctica. To map Antarctica on Street View.
Or certain parts of it, anyway.
Certain parts. It's quite large. But came out of the news last week that Google is working on bringing images of the Amazon River and its surrounding rainforest to Street View.
So, what, long-lost tribes in the jungle? Is that what this is all about?
Kind of, in a weird sort of way, I suppose, yeah. I mean, Google's been Street Viewing things for a while, as we said, but this is part of the Google Earth Outreach team, which is currently in the Amazon rainforest working with FAS, which is a non-profit conservation group. And they're basically training those guys and the locals around the area how to use Street View tools, such as their Street View bike. I imagine it's been adapted to ride through a rainforest.
An all-terrain trike.
Yeah, so the trike's going through sort of Amazon villages, dirt paths and places that have civilization in the forest. And the idea is that people will be able to go onto Street View or Google Earth into these areas and explore the rainforest exactly as they explore their own street, which, I don't know, I mean, it's one of these things you think, what's the point apart from education? But isn't that the point?
I guess the point is, yeah, it's education. It's raising awareness about the lives of these people, how they live, how they're distributed in the forest, and about kind of protecting them from big oil and from the people who want to cut the rainforest down to raise cattle and a lot of the threats facing their way of life.
Google's always said that part of its mantra was basically to organize the world's information and to make it available to everyone. Does this count as information?
I think it does. I mean, and it's information that's very difficult to obtain in any other way. I mean, it's not like these large numbers of these tribes are on the internet normally. So it's great to be able to interface with them in a different kind of way.
Well, we'll keep up to date with this. It usually takes several months for images to start popping up on Street View or Amazon River View or whatever the equivalent will be subcategorized as. But we will keep you posted and let you know as soon as you're able to browse it. I'm pretty excited. And we've got one more quick little story that we're going to get onto because I really want to argue with Duncan on air.
Like that would make a difference from any of our other stories.
Well, yeah. So there is a gallery called Art 404, which is currently exhibiting a piece by a guy called Manuel Palou, I think is probably how you pronounce
Manuel
his name.
Palou? I don't know.
It's called $5 million, 1 terabyte. And this is in inverted commas for a reason, a sculpture consisting of a 1 terabyte external hard drive containing $5 million worth of illegally downloaded files. It's on a podium, it's in a gallery, and it's apparently an art. Discuss.
You don't sound convinced by this, do you?
I mean, I'm not a big supporter of
art.
Art when it's something... No, I'm a big supporter. I'm massively into my photography. It's one of my biggest personal hobbies. It's one of my biggest interests. But I don't like art when it's something I can do. Like, I hate the argument. I could do what he did. Right, I could take a hard drive, put it on a podium, and say that's art.
But you didn't.
No, but that's not the point.
That's exactly so the point.
That's the problem I have with this, is that I could do it. And I don't like the argument where someone would say, well, you didn't do it, he did. I don't think that makes it a good thing. So what?
It's about doing it and having a message to tell with it. And I'm not sure if Palou's sort of explained very much about the motivations behind the piece. But the way I'd read it is I'd read it about a kind of comment on how much stuff you can cram into such a tiny thing. An external hard drive is very small these days, and being able to cram it with $5 million worth of stuff,
I get that,
is incredible. And for one person to be able to just accumulate $5 million of stuff and exhibit it in a gallery is also incredible.
No, because you could easily download $5 million worth of stuff. I mean, software is incredibly expensive.
But it's not about doing it, it's about making people think about what's actually on show. It's about saying what you see in front of you is worth $5 million. You know, you don't see that very often. You don't see something that's worth $5 million in front of you.
And it
calls into question, is this stuff actually worth that amount of money? Is the price that people are putting on these things fair? Is it fair that the Adobe Font collection costs $20,000?
You know what? The thing is about all this is that as much as I normally hate stuff like this, the thing that I love about it is the fact that it inspires this kind of debate and conversation. And at the end of the day, does that make something justified in its existence? You know, I mean, I've read many times that people say that art is something that its only purpose is to exist, you know, and is that what this is? I don't know.
That's a very difficult question, and probably not one we're going to be able to conquer on the podcast.
I imagine if Liv was here, she would have something to say. I imagine she's probably quite annoyed now not being able to have her say. Hello, Liv. Feel free to chime in with your two cents.
Send us an email, podcast.wired.co.uk, Liv.
Yeah, might as well. In fact, you should do that if you're listening and have a view on this. I'm very keen to hear people's opinions, particularly if they agree with me. Podcast@wired.co.uk. If you listen to it, go and write an email. What do you think? Is this an art? Is it a good art? Or is it crap?
A video game's art.
Yes, that's very different because I can't make a video game, whereas I could put a hard drive on a plinth.
But you know who can make a video game?
Is this your way of moving into a segue?
I'm trying to sort of nudge you into a segue to our next story.
Okay, we're going to move on to our first feature of this week, which concerns a certain game called Deus Ex. Yeah, Deus Ex Human Revolution, game that came out this week. Duncan and I have been playing it for about 3 weeks now, I think, because we're in that fortunate position of getting sent stuff early.
What do you think?
I kind of love it. Had my Xbox not have broken about 3 days ago, I'd probably have even more opinion on it. But before that, I was kind of loving it.
It's amazing. It's a game with so much hype behind it, and it has managed to do that incredibly rare thing, which is deliver on that hype and to make people say, yes, this is still brilliant despite all the heritage that name has.
Well, we don't know, we haven't explained what the heritage is, so
no, we should do that.
Briefly explain what Deus Ex is, because it's something that you and I click on very much.
Deus Ex is it's a game about conspiracy theories and about a kind of grim cyberpunk future, relatively near future, where people get augmentations to their body. And the original Deus Ex game, because this is actually Deus Ex 3, the original Deus Ex game came out in, I think, late 90s, early noughties.
It was around Half-Life 1.
Yeah, around that time. And it pretty much still stands as an awful lot of PC gamers' favorite game, full stop. And this kind of predates a lot of the, you know, the consoles in the same way. So it stands alone in its genre as one of the most incredible examples of storytelling, but more than that, about freedom and about freedom to do different things in a game and to play your way and not how the designer wants you to play.
Well, the other day you asked me what my game of the year so far was, and I couldn't quite bring myself to say Dragon Age 2, much as I absolutely adored that game. And I really think that, you know, when I get a new Xbox and I get to finish Deus Ex, this may very well be it, so people should maybe check it out. But in related news, as part of the fact that the game came out this week, Square Enix was wheeling a chap round who had a camera stuck in his head. His name was Rob Spence.
An actual augmented person.
Yeah, and we thought it'd be, you know, rather than getting him in to talk about Deus Ex, we thought we'll drag him in to talk about the last couple of years of his life while he's had the camera in his head and what he's been up to recently on his trip to London. In 2009, a Canadian filmmaker named Rob Spence, who lost his eye several years ago, got a team to create a prosthetic eyeball with a camera embedded in it and had it placed in his eye socket. 2 years later, Rob ended up near the Wired offices to promote a new video game called Deus Ex Human Revolution, so we've dragged him in to talk to us. Hey Rob, how you doing, mate?
How are you? I'm very well.
I'm very glad to hear it. So, you're in London. Why are you in London all of a sudden?
I'm here in London because I just did a short documentary for Deus Ex Human Revolution about cyborgs.
And you've been around talking to other cyborgs, right?
Yeah, I have just finished editing. It'll be up soon on YouTube/Deus Ex Official. And what I did basically was I saw what technology is out there now and did like a compare and contrast with Deus Ex Human Revolution, which is set in the year 2027. When everybody has the option to be completely tricked out by, you know, high-end cybernetics.
And who's been the highlight in terms of the people in your documentary?
I was particularly interested in a man I met called Mika Terho from Finland near Helsinki. He had a different kind of bionic eye. My bionic eye is not connected to my brain. It's just a camera in the hole in my head where my eye used to be, which is still pretty cool. But Mika Terho has a retinal chip that he had in at one point for a trial, a 3-month trial. And that retinal chip restores vision to him, even though he has retinitis pigmentosa. So he had vision completely restored, and he's had the most vision restored out of anybody experiencing this technology. So he could recognize bananas, read text that's 4 centimeters high. Obviously, I'm particularly interested in bionic eyes, and it was interesting for me to film his bionic eye with my bionic eye.
So I wanted to talk to you briefly about what things have been like over the last sort of couple of years since having the camera installed yourself. You said at one point that you thought it would alter people's interactions with you. Has that been the case? Have people treated you differently, obviously, with the camera?
Yeah, women I date are a little, you know, curious, let's say, about when and if I'm wearing the camera. It's something that people don't quite understand until I take some time to show them and explain to them what's going on. So yeah, definitely on the dating scene, it's an issue. Right now, the eye that I have in is quite obviously a piece of gear. It's a clear prosthetic shell, so you can see batteries and wires and things. But we're definitely planning on making a prosthetic eye camera that's painted realistically, because that's what an ocularis does now when they make a prosthetic eye, is they just paint exactly a copy of your other eye.
Can the eye now deliver better pictures than it did back in 2009?
Yeah, it gets better all the time. Unlike you puny humans who are stuck with, you know, probably slowly deteriorating eyes, mine just gets better and better. You know, 2 years from now, I'd like to have HD in there. You know, night vision. I might like to get a belt with various eyes, like Batman. That, you know, my eyeborg belt, so I can switch eyes, like a telescope eye, underwater eye, what have you. Basically, any technology that's out there and small enough, I have a space to play with. I can put whatever I want in there. And I guess what's really interesting and what came up in Deus Ex Human Revolution is that at a certain point, prosthetics will not be a fraction of what humans can do, but will exceed. And so the word will change from prosthetic possibly to augmentation. And that every indication is that will happen sooner or later. The only, as one guy who I interviewed at Össur, and they're a bionic legs company in Iceland, said, he was an engineer with a bionic leg. I asked him, how fast can you, in a couple of years, will you be able to make a leg that'll crush a brick wall? And he's like, well, honestly, we're probably not going to do that. But he said the only limitation is your imagination now, because all the technology is there and increasing every day at an exponential rate.
Well, Rob, it's been great to meet you, and thanks for coming in. Why don't you just remind people where they can see that documentary again?
Well, if you go to youtube.com/deusexofficial, you can see the 12-minute doc I did about the most advanced cybernetics that are out there today.
Rob, thanks ever so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure being here. I love Wired.
And now back to me in the studio. Thanks, me. Well, couldn't resist. That was Rob Spence. Yeah, so go and check out that documentary on YouTube. I haven't had a chance to watch it yet, but I hear it's quite different. Right, we're going to move on to our second feature this week, which takes a turn away from video games and towards the epicenter of the scientific world. No matter how much physicists try, the elusive elementary particle known as the Higgs boson continues to win every match in the global tournament of physicist hide and seek. And no matter how many billions of pounds are spent trying to find it, the boss of the bosons only seems to make scientists ask, "Are you really there?" It's an important question to find an answer to, because its discovery could prove why every particle in the known universe has mass. Recent developments flung the Higgs boson into the news again, and not necessarily for the best reasons. So our intrepid reporter Katie Scott decided to find out more.
This month has seen the search for the Higgs boson hit the headlines a lot. In late July, physicists at the Large Hadron Collider spotted a hint of the particle, but didn't have enough evidence to label this a discovery. However, this week, after a deluge of new data was studied, a range of possible masses for the particle was ruled out, and so the search goes on. We spoke to Richard Dawkins, a physicist working on CERN's ATLAS project, and mathematical physicist Peter Voigt from Columbia University to discuss whether or not this elusive particle exists and what the implications would be if it's not found. But first up, here's Richard explaining exactly what the Higgs boson is.
The Higgs boson is a missing link in our theory of fundamental physics, the particles and the forces that go between them. And this particle answers the question, or is supposed to answer the question, why are the other particles heavy? Why do they have mass? So we have a very nice theory of all of the other particles and their interactions. The only problem is it doesn't explain why they have mass. And the Higgs boson is part of the Higgs theory, which is one possible explanation of how the other particles acquire mass. And if this theory is correct, then this additional particle exists, but we don't know how heavy itself the Higgs boson is.
And here's how they're looking for it.
So what we do is we collide protons together head-on at very high energy, and we basically look at what comes out. When you collide protons, the protons break up. The things inside the protons are made up of quarks and gluons, smaller particles. They collide and they produce all sorts of debris. Sometimes they collide to produce quarks, gluons, and other things. Some processes are rarer than others, and we expect if the Higgs boson is produced, very occasionally we will get a Higgs boson being produced in the experiment. So the idea is basically to produce a lot of collisions, record everything that happens in those collisions with the ATLAS experiment, and then to sift through those collisions and look for the signature of a Higgs boson being produced and decaying. It decays into other particles, and we look for those other particles that it decays into.
The past month has been a roller coaster for the scientists at CERN. Richard explains what has happened.
Just to give you a little bit of the history, every summer in the particle physics world, there's a couple of, usually two or three, big conferences. There was a conference towards the end of July in Grenoble in France, and there both ATLAS and the other big experiment, which is searching also for the Higgs boson, both reported their results on the data which we had taken so far up to the end of June. And those results showed us, started to give us some hints that maybe we were seeing things in the data which were compatible with the signature of Higgs bosons decaying at a particular mass value. So that caused a great deal of excitement. The hints we were seeing were intriguing, but they were not enough. They were nowhere near enough to claim that we were actually seeing this Higgs boson. Now, since that time, the Large Hadron Collider accelerator has been working very well, and we've acquired some more data, almost twice as much data as we had to analyze then. So we've continued our analysis. We've looked at this additional data. We've also refined our analysis of the data we had already before the other conference, and we've improved our results. And then just this week, there's another big particle physics conference going on in Mumbai in India, and there the experiments were presenting their latest updated results, And what we found there is that when we look with the latest data at this region where we thought we were seeing hints, possible hints of the Higgs boson, now the hint isn't quite so strong. So as we've sort of looked in more detail, got more data, more analysis, we're not seeing quite as strong a hint of the Higgs boson as we thought we were before. So the kind of the level of excitement in the community has gone down a little bit in terms of thinking that we're on the verge of seeing this. On the other hand, this is very interesting because the other thing we can do with this data is to look for regions where we might expect to see the Higgs boson, and if we don't see it, we can exclude those regions. So the regions where we might expect to see the Higgs boson and haven't seen it, those exclusion regions have grown. So if you like, we're zeroing in or narrowing down where we might expect to see the Higgs boson.
Peter says the discoveries announced this week could either mean the scientists at CERN have managed to narrow down their search range and therefore are closer than ever to that ultimate discovery, or that the particle simply doesn't exist.
I think it's a very interesting situation. So what has happened is that they've shown that this isn't this thing doesn't exist at certain masses, and they have narrowed down the range to a relatively narrow range of possible places it could still be. And this is the range which, you know, for the last few years people have been expecting to be the most likely place for it to be. But it's also still true that this is exactly what you would expect to happen if it's not there. This range is also exactly the range which is the hardest for them to see anything. So if the thing actually really isn't there, this is exactly what you would expect to happen. They would keep narrowing the region down, and this would be the last one to go. So it's I think it's still a completely open question. Is it there or is it not there? And I hope we should find out maybe by the end of the year.
But, he argues, discovering the Higgs boson doesn't exist could actually be a cathartic moment for physicists worldwide.
I think what physicists don't often say is that if the Higgs boson actually is found with exactly the properties expected, that's in some sense very depressing for physicists. It's a great success story for this theory, but it means that we won't really have learned very much new. And there are a lot of things about this theory of the Higgs particle and what it's supposed to do, which we aren't very happy with, which we don't understand very well. And what we would love to happen actually is to not have this show up exactly the way it's supposed to, but to have something different that will give us new hints as to what is really going on.
And what of the future? What are the alternatives to the Higgs mechanism?
I think the interesting thing about this is that there really aren't any good ones. There's nobody else has a really convincing alternative to the Higgs mechanism, as you know, to this Higgs particle. There are, people have tried doing a lot of different things, but the things they've come up with all have their own problems and don't really do what you want and are not. And are kind of unconvincing in various ways. So if if you don't see a Higgs particle, it means there's something that you don't understand going on there, and it's also something that you don't seem to have any good ideas about. So it would be kind of a wide open field at that point.
And finally, what does Richard think is next for the scientists at CERN?
If it is found, we have to study it in more detail. I mean, the first thing will be to If we see these hints, and if the hints eventually get confirmed, then we know we're seeing something new. And then it's a separate question, a follow-up question, to say, is this really the Higgs boson of the standard model of particle physics? Is it something a bit more complicated? There are some theories which say there might be several Higgs bosons, so we need to continue to see if any other Higgs bosons show up, and try to measure the properties of this Higgs boson to see if it's compatible with what we expect from the theory, and try and learn more about it. If we don't see it, then the experiments being done at the Large Hadron Collider have also got a very good chance of discovering whatever else there is if the Higgs boson theory is not correct. So we will continue to run the collider and the experiments for the next 20 years or so in order to try and explore as much as we can. Even if the Higgs boson exists, it's certainly not the end of the story. And if it doesn't exist, then there are many other things that we also want to look for.
Thanks to both Richard and Peter for their time. This is Katie Scott for the wired.co.uk podcast.
Amazebears. Thanks, Katie. I can't help but feel like this boson is never going to show its face.
Do you really think so? It'd be interesting.
That's the end of our show. It's been quite a long one this week, despite the fact that we are sans live. But Duncan, why not tell people how they can email us?
You can email us on podcast@wired.co.uk, and you definitely should. You can also follow us on Twitter. We are @wiredUK. Nate is @NateLangson, and I am @DuncanGear.
And Olivia, of course, is Olivia_Solon. We've got an amazing Facebook page. It's getting more amazing by the minute. In fact, since I started talking and since now, it's got slightly more amazing.
2.5%.
Probably because Alice is upstairs posting stuff on it right now. It's facebook.com/wiredUK. Go and hit the like button and start a conversation. Talk about something. I don't even care what it is. I just want to talk to you.
Art. Robots.
Don't talk about art. Do talk about robots. And I think that's it.
I think that's it.
I think until next week, stay excellent to each other.
Bye-bye. I know you're not into, you know, tastes.
I'm not into food. I just don't like taste. Don't like taste. Don't like taste. Don't like taste.